Are you tired of searching for great talk radio?
Something more important.
Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got, coming up next is Tony Gosling, and let me tell you a little bit about Tony. He was born in Gravesend, Kent, 1962. He's brought up in Bromley, South London. My gosh, he's got his formal education was in Hickley College, West Yorkshire. Went on with a humanities degree, specializing in English literature from Bradford University. He's had several positions with BBC Radio. He's been an officer of the National Union of Journalists and so forth. He's a Quaker. And right now he has a drive time program in Bristol, England. Welcome to our program, Tony Gosling.
Lovely to be back, George. Thanks for inviting me on again.
Oh, man, I'll tell you what. What's going on in England and this Savile? Is that the way you pronounce that? Jimmy Savile? Is that his name?
Yeah, well, Jimmy Savile, people in the States won't necessarily know this, but, I mean, many of us that grew up in the 60s and 70s remember Jimmy Savile as this sort of friendly face of pop culture on the TV. He used to introduce our weekly program that parents and children would gather around the TV to watch every week, the Top of the Pops, to see all this incredible music coming out in the late 60s and early 70s. He was a presenter of that. He was a presenter on the Radio 1 of music on what was then the BBC's, you know, sort of premier pop music station, which was brought into sort of takeover from the pirates. Pirate stations were very big here in the late 60s, and the BBC wasn't playing pop music, so they brought Radio 1 in, and Jimmy was a presenter on there. So he really represented for a lot of people pop culture. Then he went on to television in a more serious way with his own program, which was called Jim Will Fix It. And Jim fixed it for a lot of young children, really with their hopes and dreams. And they would say, for example, you know, I would like to fly an airliner or something, and write a little letter into Jimmy at BBC Television Centre saying, can you fix it for me to fly an airliner? And Jimmy would then somehow, you know, pick people out of the pool there of letters coming in, I mean, you know, sackfuls of mail, and get them to do the thing that they really wanted to do as a child. I mean, it would be all sorts of things. For example, you know, sort of play with animals at the zoo. All their dreams were fulfilled on TV by Jimmy Savile. So he was a very big figure as part of that popular culture in those days. Now, this scandal, the way it's broken, right now in the middle of this. I mean, it's been going on for a couple of weeks in very, you know, very, very sort of overt form here in the UK. But it's developed into what is essentially a television war. And this is actually a quite healthy way that television stations should be and could be competing with each other, which is to expose deep flaws and failings within competing channels. And the BBC's flaws were exposed a couple of weeks ago when ITV, which is the independent commercial TV network, aired a documentary all about this Jimmy Savile, which was essentially saying the same story that the BBC had reported on. Funnily enough, a reporter that I worked with in London had worked on this story for the BBC, and then the BBC at Christmas time last year decided they weren't going to transmit this report on Jimmy Savile's paedophilia. Now, this on its own is a pretty terrible thing, because they had a tribute series to Savile coming out that the BBC Newsnight decided to spike the story. Then what happened was nobody seemed to want to touch this in television because it was too contentious. The main reason being, of course, I mean, if you sit and think about it, and from a union point of view, you know, as a trade unionist and a journalist union person, you know, we often get stories that the higher-ups, the bosses and the managers, don't want transmitted for one reason or another, and that was the case here. Because there were a lot of people who were managers at the BBC in senior positions who were implicated. In fact, the fact that they hadn't worked on the complaints by ordinary people, ordinary staff, low-level staff, about Jimmy Savile's paedophile behaviour on BBC premises, actually made them complicit in his crimes. And so you had a very pernicious kind of situation developing there, where the senior officials at the BBC many of them knew about this and realised that because they hadn't acted in the past, that they were going to be implicated if they were to act on these allegations. So there's, I mean, not to excuse the police for not acting either, but there was an establishment cover-up at the BBC, and it was really good to see a few weeks ago that the competing network, ITV, aired all of this. The information pretty much that had been gathered on Jimmy Savile and a really pretty shocking documentary. So media wars and the BBC are in the frame. Even today, there's articles in the newspapers over here explaining that the BBC press office have been lying about what that was in the content of this Newsnight BBC story back in December that was spiked. So as you can see, there is a whole load of nasty stuff going on behind the scenes at good old Auntie. And, you know, many people saw in the 60s and 70s the BBC as a very friendly organisation, and it's pretty shocking to see that somebody who was trusted by the nation was, committing these kind of heinous acts with young children. I'm told personally by people that I know have worked there and worked closely with him, rape actually went on BBC premises. And this is why I think that the senior management are really implicated. This is the problem. Jimmy's acts were not just his own. They also included, the knowledge of it was included amongst senior BBC people. And so, in a way, this is a bit of a catharsis for the corporation, I hope, that anybody that is standing in the way of a proper investigation, including, it seems at the moment, the new Director General, is not really acquitting himself very well here, because he's refusing to see the reporters who did the BBC story on this that wasn't transmitted. And anyone that stands in the way of a proper inquiry, I think, is going to be dead meat within a few months, George.
Yeah, you know, are any of the royals being touched by this right now?
Not that I know of. One thing I can say is that the NSPCC, the National Council for Protection of Children, has been saying that they have now something like 200 allegations against 200 people that Jimmy Savile is alleged to have molested. And it looks as if he, as an individual, as a television presenter, was one of the worst child molesters that they have ever come across anywhere in Britain. And it's incredible, isn't it, that he was somebody who was at the time being put forward in front of all of our young people in the 1960s and 1970s as a great pop idol. Now, when this story first broke a couple of weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago as a major story, I was a bit... my journalistic instinct was, hang on a minute, the guy's dead, you know, we really shouldn't be making these sort of allegations. But it's becoming clearer and clearer, and certainly through the grapevine, when I was working in London at the BBC, there were people who told me there, oh, Jimmy Savile, you know, this is one of those darkest secrets of the BBC. That was
right.
Years ago, nearly. I knew that there were some rumours, but I did feel that it would have been much better for this to have happened while he was still alive. And it's
okay,
become clear now.
We gotta go. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome back to our program, Tony Gosling from Bristol, England.
Yeah, thanks, George. The Jimmy Savile business, just refreshing your listeners, this is appalling, isn't it? That one of the biggest,
yes, it is.
If not the biggest sex offender in British history was looked after and able to do his dirty work on BBC premises. Quite unbelievable. And you might say, well, hey, guys, this is just a one-off. But I can tell you, here at the BBC runs several regional hubs, one of them here in Bristol. We're about 100, 120 miles west of London. And we have one of our Radio Bristol presenters currently doing 6 years in jail for sex attacks as well. He's a former independent TV presenter and BBC Radio Bristol presenter called Peter Rowell. He was pleaded guilty to indecently assaulting five girls under the age of 16. It does indicate, doesn't it, that there was some kind of culture that
promiscuity
of various sorts was acceptable at the BBC.
Yeah, Tony, what is it about these people at the high level of power or public, you know what I mean, exposure and so forth? How do they get into that? Do they run out of kicks at the lower levels and they just
kick here? And I mean, well, a lot of people that work in broadcasting. Yep. And in other sorts of, you know, high levels editors, some of them of newspapers, this kind of thing, is I think that the managers like to employ people like this because they know that they've got dirt on them. I think the same is true for politicians too. That they actually rather like to employ somebody that they've got, they can hold this sort of 10-ton weight over their head and say, look, if you step out of line, this is going to come crashing down your head. And that this is a sort of mafia-style tactic that's been adopted both in our media, in politics, in the church, this kind of thing. That the techniques and the people who are actually doing the recruiting in the old personnel departments or human resources, as they're called now, departments of various big businesses and within places like the church and elsewhere, that one of the factors when promoting people towards the top of these organizations is they want to make sure that they're going to be pliable. Yeah, they're going to be like plasticine and putty in the hands of the people who manage things behind the scenes and obviously the boards of these organizations. I mean, we had a child abduction case recently here in Britain where a teacher took the young child, 15-year-old, off to France on a holiday against the wishes of her parents and everything. And it turned out that one of the governors of that school had actually been was a convicted paedophile priest of some sort, was actually still a governor of the school. One of the other things that's come out recently is that although our police and crime commissioners, which are a little bit like your police commissioners in the United States, they're just bringing that in over here, God forbid, but when they do, they are very heavily vetted. But the thing is, the actual senior police officers themselves are not vetted at all. The police authorities who employ them are supposed to vet them, but then they say, oh, well, we thought the Home Office was doing it. That's in London, you know, the sort of central thing that runs the police from London, with the Home Secretary in charge. And everyone's saying, well, we thought you were vetting these police, but nobody is vetting some of the senior police in Britain. So this is a problem which is endemic. And I think Anthony Hall, I'm reminded of, who's written this book, Earth into Property, which is the slow descent into a kind of system where ownership is everything. Now, privatisation obviously has been a large part of that. Here in Britain, we've been privatising since the 1980s. A lot of our essential services like water, gas, electricity are now run by private companies. And as you privatise that stuff, you're actually taking it out of the democratic control. You're one step removed or two or three steps removed from democratic control. In those sorts of organisations, particularly the media and the police, and I would include in that the security services, you know, the military police, these kinds of organisations, I think the people who are actually running those organisations like to have people that they have power over in those positions. And that's one of the things I think is really wrong in the Western world right now, that there is this kind of network, informal if you want, or partly formal, possibly Masonic connections, that those have been exposed quite clearly within the Leveson inquiry, which is going on in Britain at the moment, into phone hacking by Rupert Murdoch's empire, and possibly even worse, phone tapping, which is a serious criminal offence by Murdoch's empire. That is also all tied in with these Masonic networks, because they were using Freemasonic lodges to actually recruit public officials to get information from them, to get stories. And, you know, we ended up with the News of the World being one of the best-selling newspaper, basically because they were getting stories. But nobody actually would give them these stories because they didn't trust the people who were running it. And this was a horrendous situation to be in, where you've got a newspaper empire, the Murdoch empire, that people would much rather go elsewhere for stories, but they are basically stealing their stories. They're running basically a criminal gang from the newsroom that's going out and stealing stories. So the media and the police together, I think, both are complicit with, and potentially with Freemasonic, I mean, we've seen with the phone hacking thing, there definitely was Masonic networks being used to illegally gather information and to recruit people, George.
Right. What's happening with in relationship to the European Union? They just received the Nobel Peace Prize. Are you kidding me? What was that about?
Well, it seems like some kind of bad joke. The only thing I can suggest is maybe nowadays the Nobel Peace Prize is dished out to people in order to sort of guilt trip them into not starting a war, because it looks like the Baroness Ashton, who's the foreign minister for the European Union, who's never been elected in her life to anything. I mean, she was the treasurer of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, unbelievably, back in the 1980s. And I'm told she wasn't even elected treasurer because no one else wanted to do the job. She was made a baroness in the House of Lords. Nobody elected her to do that. And then she was sort of spirited, transported up to the European Union, and she's now making decisions about foreign policy and whether sanctions are going to be put on what our relationship is going to be with Russia, China, and with Iran and Syria. I mean, it's just beyond the joke that somebody with such power can just be beyond. And of course, she answers as a baroness to Prince Charles and the Queen, not to any of the electorate, and not even really to the EU itself or members of the European Parliament.
That shows how powerful the Queen is, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly indicates that there is a lot of power behind the scenes, George. And, you know, there's been another story over here, I'm not sure if you picked up on it, to do with Prince Charles and the Black Spider letters. Have you heard about that one?
No, tell us about that. Tell us about that.
Well, this is letters that Prince Charles has been sending backwards and forwards to British government departments over the last 10 years or so. And the Guardian newspaper, bless them, put in a Freedom of Information request to see these letters backwards and forwards between Charles and various government departments. 27 letters sent to various different departments of the Labour government. Business department, health department, education, environment, culture, Northern Ireland, including the Cabinet Office, which does all the arrangements for the government itself to meet, at Downing Street. And quite rightly, under the Freedom of Information Act, a whole bunch of law lords got together and decided that these letters should all be released. Now, they were called the Black Spider Letters because Prince Charles's handwriting apparently is very spidery, and he writes in this kind of black ink. Anyway, this whole process was about to explode because the monarchy is supposed to be a sort of figurehead thing that has nothing to do with government. But it's quite clear that Charles has been interfering. One of the most recent stories was that his mum, the Queen, phoned up the Home Secretary at the time back in about 4 or 5 years ago, David Blunkett, and said, "Well, we want you to arrest radical preachers. Why haven't you arrested them yet? And there must be some law you can get them on, so get them under arrest now." Now, to me, that is a gross political interference by the Queen. Now, she can't have it both ways, and Prince Charles can't have it both ways. Either they are figurehead monarchs, in which case they should keep their nose out of politics and keep it out of the legal profession, and they should just sit there and become a symbolic kind of figure for tourists to point their binoculars at.
Okay,
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Welcome back to our program, Tony Gosley, from Bristol, England.
Thank you, George.
Was there anything you wanted to add on the letters of Prince Charles and so forth? And
it's a constitutional nightmare, isn't it? I mean, you know, we're supposed to be a democracy, and yet you've got this Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family, who, by the way, I was reading recently, it was the Saxe-Gotha family, part of that family, who looked after a certain guy called Adam Weishaupt over in Germany, in Bavaria, after he'd been outed as a satanic conspirator as part of his setting up of the Illuminati. They were outed in Germany and exposed, and he was discredited family actually took him under their wing, gave him a nice library to use, and a pension, and looked after him, made sure he was going to be fine for the rest of his life. This family is now the family that's ruling Britain. They changed their name, as many people know, in the First World War, because the Gotha bombers were actually coming over from Germany and bombing Britain, and it wasn't seen to be very good that the Queen was a Gotha, or the King was a Gotha at the time, you know, so they changed their name from Gotha, Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor to make it look like they were a British family. So this, you know, is not quite clearly. And the Queen still has a lot of power in regards to appointment of the highest levels of the judiciary. So that was sort of understood. But the idea that she's she and Prince Charles are both interfering directly with government ministers, trying to get people arrested, and also making it clear that they will veto certain proposals if they go through and they affect the monarchy adversely, is totally against our constitution, and it underlines the fact that we do not live in a democracy. It's much more like some kind of elective dictatorship.
Right, exactly. Hey, there are two other items or two other things I want to cover before this last segment is over. One is, what's going to happen to the UK and Europe, the European Union? They've stayed outside of that, converting over to the Euro monetary unit. Where does UK stand now as far as the European Union goes? What's going to happen?
Well, I think we're a funny kind of country, aren't we? The Europeans never really trusted Britain because we were seen as too close to the United States after the Second World War. And in fact, for many years, there were attempts to keep us out of the European Union, particularly by the French, who never trusted the British, I think quite wisely in many ways. And they never trusted NATO very wisely, the French. You know, they always saw themselves as one step removed from that. Now, you know, that, so quite whether Britain is going to move closer towards Europe, I think now it's unlikely, because the Eurozone is now seen to be this kind of totally kind of poisonous death cult with, you know, with the that currency that was mooted as the saviour of all European economies is now sucking everybody down into this sort of cesspit of appalling austerity. And again, it's the Germans in the driving seat. Now, this is one of the things which I think is in the backs of the minds of many people right across Europe, is, hang on a minute, this is a kind of a financial war that Germany is waging on the rest of Europe. Certainly, the Greeks see it like that. I mean, that's very, very, you know, it's a very common view in Greece that this is just a kind of picking up where the Second World War left off. And it's a form of economic warfare on their country, and that their government has been captured by crooked people who are essentially being paid to destroy their own country, are traitors. And so I think there's a real pernicious attitude in Europe to the way that the euro is being used as a way to sort of punish the weaker economies and effectively make Germany a more powerful and successful country. I mean, we're seeing here in Britain, you know, over the last 10 years, more and more German products, more and more German goods. Our British car industry is completely gone, and more and more German, therefore more and more German cars on our roads. And I think, you know, the same is true in the US. Quite a lot of the American car companies have been bought up by German car companies. In fact, a guy that lives just down the road from here in Wiltshire, Harry Beckhoff, who's a former MI6 officer, has written a whole book about the, it's called the Fourth Reich. And he's written a book examining, amongst other things, a whole load of different companies around the United States and Europe, you know, including ones you'll recognize, such as Chrysler, Random House, RCA, Westinghouse Electric Company, all of which are now owned by companies like Siemens, BMG Entertainment, Daimler-Benz, which are all German companies. And we have a similar thing here in Britain. You know, a lot of our chemists, Rolls-Royce, for example, are now owned by Volkswagen. Kleinwort Benson, which was one of the biggest city global investment banks, is now owned by Dresden Bank. Boots Pharmaceuticals has been taken over by what was actually a post-Nazi company, BASF. So what is pretty clear to anyone that bothers to look is that there is a far greater power. And I tell you, George, I actually think of some of these big corporations today almost like, you know, armored tank divisions and infantry divisions. That although they're virtual, they're equally as powerful and equally as able to take over ownership of our economy, of our factories, of our land, and much of our culture. You know, if you're thinking about the entertainment industry, the media, our culture is now owned by often by foreign interests. I mean, sometimes it's British people that are actually owning it, and foreign people that own the shares. So it appears to be, you know, sort of run by Brits, or it may over there appear to be run by Americans, but actually the shares are owned by other companies. So, you know, it's a kind of a financial empire. I think Harry actually was working during the Second World War, and he, one of the things he did, it was his job, for example, to go around the German universities after World War II and denazify them, because he had all the Gestapo files on the various lecturers and professors, and he would interview them to see if they were being honest. So I would thoroughly recommend his book. It's called Germany's Four Reichs: Origins and Development, Seeking World Domination in Ruthless Terror, by Harry Beckhoff. And I'll just spell his name because it's a bit difficult, which is Beckhoff. And he's in his 90s now, but he's quite convinced that what we're facing in the West is basically a financial army of corporations who are attempting to buy up everything around us, all kinds of property. And
well, it's public-private partnership. Yeah, is it public-private partnerships that Thatcher initiated in UK, or what? Who started that in the UK? Was it Thatcher?
Well, it was under Thatcher, but it was, you know, actually increased as well. I mean, privatization started with Thatcher, but they were all, this is really one of the latest. I think it may even have been under the Labour government, under Blair, that they really accelerated these things. But ultimately, the idea is to move as much as possible away from the government. So everything is being done by these private boards, private businesses, who are, you know, appointed by private individuals for their own private profit and private gain, so that when we vote in an election, it has less and less meaning every year. Every extra piece of privatisation of whatever facilities and services we as ordinary members of the public need, whether that be water, electricity, you know, sort of basic utilities, the legal system, you know, even government itself, the more it's privatised, the less every single vote means, because the most, more and more of our system is being monopolised and taken over and exploited. Especially if it's an essential service, by these cartels, by energy cartels, and by health cartels. I mean, you know, our National Health Service here in Britain was set up after the Second World War for one very simple reason, and that was when we were pulling one of our neighbours out of a house that had just been bombed, the last thing we wanted to ask them was, where's your health insurance? Everybody was in it together, and we wanted to look after each other. So that was why the National Health Service was put together. That is now facing these kind of, as you were saying, private-public partnerships, PPIs, which means that everybody, the state, our taxpayers, are paying something like twice as much as we should be for all of the hospital facilities and the school facilities, and a massive amount of money is being creamed up by the private sector.
Right. You know, there's a list that I got up called the Network of Global Corporate Control, and it says, isn't Barclays PLC at the top? Does that pretty coincide with what your view is?
Yes, absolutely. I think Barclays and actually HSBC Bank, probably even worse than them, George. You know, these guys that were doing the armored vehicles, moving money around for the Mexican drug cartel.
They are
financial criminals, financial terrorists, and they need to be arrested and tried. And the financial services sector needs to be taken over by the people and by the government.
Okay, Tony, thank you for being with us this evening. We appreciate you getting up so early there.
It's about 2 in the morning here now, so I'm not George. I'd like to plug quickly my show, which is
Okay, thank you, Tony.
Hi, this is Ted Anderson.